today on Against the Grain. If global poverty is a problem for security, the question becomes whose security? The security of acutely poor people around the globe, or the security of elites, of political leaders and the upper class? I'm CS. Akhil Gupta traces fundamental shifts in the ways poverty and security have been viewed and discussed, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Poverty is a problem for the poor. That's uncontroversial. People suffer because they are poor. But what if poverty, global poverty, is seen less as a problem for the poor than as a problem for the rich? What if elites in the wealthy nations see global poverty as a problem, as a threat to them, to their health and well-being? Unchecked migration, terrorism, and disease vectors are seen in elite circles as some of the principal manifestations of that threat. Akhil Gupta has studied and written about how discourses of poverty and security have come together in ways that make meaningful poverty alleviation less rather than more likely. He also calls into question the dichotomy of global North versus global South, in light of what he sees as the changing geographies of poverty in our neoliberal capitalist era. Akhil Gupta is professor of anthropology at UCLA, where he directs the Center for India and South Asia. He contributed an essay entitled, "Is Poverty a Global Security Threat?" to the new volume, "Territories of Poverty, Rethinking North and South." When Akhil joined me from a studio at UCLA, I asked him whether national security was the main way in which security was conceptualized during the Cold War.
Yes, this was actually the primary way in which security was understood. It was understood in terms of national security. And what I try to show is that something changes in the way that security comes to be defined after the end of the Cold War.
So what did the end of the Cold War do to the ways that security was thought about in academic and policy circles?
The end of the Cold War basically caused people to rethink what security might mean, because the idea was that during the Cold War, there was a clearly defined enemy, and national security meant protecting the nation state against that enemy, which was also defined in national state terms. After the end of the Cold War, the question was, well, if we no longer have this enemy who is going to destroy us or is threatening to destroy us, then how do we think about security and how do we think about national security? And in particular, there arose the discourse after the end of the Cold War that all the resources that were being spent on the Cold War now could be used for positive social change. And this was the idea of the peace dividend. So at this time, there arose the idea that, well, security couldn't just be thought of in terms of national security, arms control, the nuclear threat, those kinds of issues, but had to, especially with the changes in the climate and with environmental destruction becoming a top order priority, the idea that you had to think about security in environmental terms, in human terms, and you had to think of the security of people and citizens within a nation state and not just the entity of the nation state itself.
Yeah, you write that guaranteeing the security of the state, of the nation state, didn't necessarily mean safeguarding the security of its people, right? Who might in fact be harmed by the policies of the nation in which they live.
Yes. So if, for example, you had totalitarian regimes or ethnically divided nation states in which one faction was in control of the nation state and used the resources of the nation state to wage war on the other faction or on ethnic minorities, then that was a situation in which some people in the nation state were acutely insecure, yet the discourse on national security actually didn't do anything for them. It didn't help think about their vulnerability in those conditions.
Now, in the 1990s, you note that there was a shift in poverty discourse to human security. There was a move from the language of human development to human security. In what ways did a report issued by the UN Development Program, I think it was in 1994, mark or effect this shift?
The 1994 report by the Human Development Report, which was edited and shepherded by Mehboob al-Haq, the economist who first gave us the idea of human development, marked a shift in the language that was used for human development towards a notion of human insecurity, human security. And the argument was that to focus on human security would basically narrow in some ways the idea of human development, and it would focus on the issues that most needed to be focused on, which is the vulnerability, the extremely vulnerable parts of the population, and the causes, the reasons why they became so vulnerable to various risks.
And what was wrong with human development, the term that had been used, how was it seen to be inadequate to this particular task?
So the idea was that human development was a very wide-ranging term. It included, for example, the idea that various kinds of potentialities of people needed to be included in the idea of human development, whereas human security focused on those things that made people particularly vulnerable, that threatened their life in some way. And so it was much more things that mattered immediately and directly to the population.
I see. And so, for example, maybe human development would encompass the right to education or educational services of a certain level, whereas human security might focus more on food and very basic necessities for survival.
That's right. And alongside that was also included the idea that food, shelter, clothing, medical aid, things that were absolutely necessary for survival were given top priority, but also things like, you know, violence that came from in the form of ethnic conflict or genocide or sexual violence, all of those things were also threats to human security. So the idea of human security combined some parts of the agenda of human development with human rights and with security issues.
What you are saying about maybe the advantages of using the term and the concept human security in place of human development, were the strength of these arguments enough to convince people to come on board with this concept, or were there other reasons why this concept caught on?
I think the main reason that the concept caught on, and it did catch on extremely fast. So once the idea of human security was proposed, it was actually taken up by a whole range of international actors. It became used, for example, in the campaign against landmines. It was part of various international institutions. It was adopted by various international institutions. And it caught something of the moment. And I think the context was ripe for this kind of idea. And once it was introduced, it quickly became a kind of mainstream concept.
And you're right that it was also vague enough, the concept of human security, that different actors could mobilize around it.
Yes. So that is a very important property, actually, of any idea that becomes a big idea like global poverty. If it's too precise, then it is also limited. But if different people can support it, And they might mean different things by it. They may not mean the same thing. But if they can support it for their own reasons, and there is enough convergence in their meaning and the meaning of other actors, then it catches on and it becomes like this boundary concept that crosses over from one domain of ideas to another. And so that's exactly what human security did.
Akhil Gupta joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. He is professor of anthropology at UCLA, where he also directs the Center for India and South Asia. So we've been talking about the shift from national security to thinking about the security of the people within a nation state. We've talked about the shift in certain circles from the language of human development to human security. You also trace in this article in the volume Territories of Poverty, you also trace global poverty as a term and a concept. How long has this term been around, and when did it gain prominence?
When I first started my academic career, which was in the late 70s and early 80s, I almost never heard the term global poverty. Very few people were talking about global poverty. Global poverty became an important term after globalization became an important phenomenon. So in the sense that, and I don't mean globalization as a phenomenon, but the discourse about globalization. So when in the late 80s and early 90s, you see the rise of globalization as both a promise and a problem for the world, and it becomes part of the discourse of businesses and governments and academic work, it's at that time, only after that, that you see the rise of global poverty as a phenomenon. And so what I did was I just, in a very rough manner, I traced how many references there were to the term global poverty in popular magazines and newspapers, etc. And what I found was that after about 1999, this term suddenly becomes much more high profile and starts being used in a lot of different places. So before that, you do get the term global poverty, but it's not a concept that has very much currency.
And what accounts for the term's emergence on a rather large scale?
Part of the reason why the term global poverty becomes so popular is, again, it's a term that can mean different things to different people. It's also correlated very strongly with global inequality. So once you get globalization and growing global inequalities that result from globalization, by global inequality, I mean not just inequality between the global north and the global south, but also inequality within the global north and the global south. So you get growing inequalities within nation states. And it's at that time that you see the rise of the term global poverty.
Interestingly, you write that global poverty refers to a depoliticized concern with acute poverty, with poverty around the world. Why depoliticized?
So when poverty was a problem for nation states, and before you get the rise of global poverty, you have a lot that is said and policy discourse about poverty, but it was always in the context of nation states. So when you get the rise of global poverty as a problem facing the world, basically what that says is that all the poor people in the world can be put together in the same category. That once we invent a category of the globally poor and we define it as $1 a day, people who live for under $1 a day or people who live under $2 a day, that there is some reason why we should actually classify people and include them in this category of people who live under $1 a day. Now, it turns out that people who live under $1 a day in different parts of the world are poor because of very different reasons. They're not poor for the same reasons. And in fact, it's a very bad measure of poverty to begin with. People who live under $1 a day may actually have many different living standards, but that is not captured by the idea of a certain benchmark that you use, because obviously costs of living are very different in different countries and purchasing power is very different. So in some countries, $1 might get you quite a lot. In other countries, it might get you nothing at all. And so it's a very bad measure. But more than that, it includes people who are poor because, you know, for example, of the ill effects of colonialism on their countries, and people who are poor because of inequality in their countries. And those two might be very different sets of people. There might be very different reasons why they're poor. It includes the urban poor with the rural poor. So it basically treats everybody who's poor as abject classificatory bundle. And it makes them the objects of aid and charity. But it doesn't in any way illuminate the reasons why they are poor to begin with.
Now, could that disadvantage be made up by the fact that, as you write, you know, calls to address global poverty became very strong, especially by the mid-2000s, the decade of the noughts. So at least by, you know, certainly you're lumping people together, you're simplifying a problem, you're not offering any context for poverty as it exists in different regions and different nations, but at least people can rally around the term and maybe do more in relation to it than if that term had not been made so prominent?
Yes, absolutely. Global poverty is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it does exactly what you're suggesting. It rallies people to a cause, and it basically identifies a problem that everybody can get behind. But it's mainly in the context of increasing the amount of aid that is going to the very poor. So that's the context in which it's a positive step. It's not very positive in that it evades the reasons, it basically evades an analysis of the reasons why people are poor in different places in the world. And to that extent, it inhibits the ability to actually combat that poverty, because it doesn't ask the main question it doesn't ask is the question of global inequality. And you have to see it in the context of globalization. At the very time that free trade agreements are being pushed relentlessly, and at the very time that, in fact, global inequality is growing rapidly, that's the time when you see ideas about global poverty becoming very prominent.
Was there also something problematic about global poverty discourse arising in a context of neoliberalism and neoliberal capitalism and global commodity markets? In other words, did global poverty discourse tend to look for solutions in the realm of existing political economic systems that may not in fact help the poor or may not in fact be able to help the poor?
That's exactly right. So what you get is the effort on the one hand to push with neoliberal reforms, market solutions, etc. And then, of course, that creates greater inequality and it pushes a lot of people into poverty. For example, you know, a well-known side effect of NAFTA is that a lot of small peasant producers in Mexico went out of business because they could no longer afford to grow corn. And then once those people have been thrown out of jobs or out of occupations, they no longer have the means to support themselves, then they are part of the global poor. And then you try to solve the problem of their poverty by giving them aid or other such things. To the extent that it did result in more aid being given to the poor, that was good. But much of that, I would argue, was actually caused by the very solutions that many of these leaders who were campaigning against global poverty, that many of these leaders had in fact created the conditions that led to poverty in the first place.
And who are some of those leaders?
I mean, the leaders of the global north is what I would say. Tony Blair was one of them. And the people like Jeff Sachs in the US, whose idea about global poverty made it to the cover of Time magazine. So there are thought leaders and there are political leaders and there are policy leaders who are in charge of global development. And it was that whole consortium of people who in the 80s and 90s had relentlessly pushed market-based solutions for development. And those market-based solutions had, in fact, created global inequalities and inequalities within countries that often ended up pushing people who were middle class or lower middle class into poverty.
And so you write that the advocates of this concept, global poverty, did not see poverty as being created by global or structural inequalities. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And Akhil Gupta joins us. He teaches anthropology at UCLA. His books include Red Tape, Bureaucracy, Structural Violence, and Poverty in India, and Postcolonial Developments, Agriculture and the Making of Modern India. And he wrote an essay called Is Poverty a Global Security Threat?, which is part of the new volume, Territories of Poverty, Rethinking North and South. We have links to Akhil and his work on our website, againstthegrain.org. So earlier you were telling me about the emergence of this concept of human security, which focused, unlike maybe human development, focused more on the basic needs of people, their need to survive, their need not to be confronted with violence or hunger. And you write that the subject of security, that is, the people whose security was to be emphasized, changed after 9/11. But let's start with before 9/11. So before 9/11, we have this discourse of human security. Who were the subjects of security in the minds of people who thought these thoughts?
So human security was concerned with poor people, right? So the idea was that we are worried about the security of the very poor, and human security draws attention to the provision of goods and services to the poor, but also to other aspects that basically threatened their lives and their livelihoods. So when I say the subject of human security, what I mean is, when I talked about how the subject has changed, what I mean is that the term, whom does the term refer to, right? So human security was unambiguously referred to very poor people, mostly in the global south.
Okay, well, that makes good sense. And then what happens to the focus or the target or the agent of security after 9/11 and why?
So this is a very interesting question. After 9/11, what happens is that the idea of human security changes so that the documents and the discourse after 9/11, which is emphasizing human security, takes this idea that human security is mainly a problem for poor people in the global south, and changes it to mean that human security is our security. It's the security of all of us. And the us is never stated. Who is this us? But this is what I mean by the subject of security discourse. But the us whose security is to be secured becomes the elite in the global north.
The elite in the global north now has to be made secure. That's then the focus of human security discourse?
That is what happens after 9/11, because the idea is that suddenly we are all vulnerable to terrorism, that it can strike at any time. So before the nation state was being threatened by another nation state. Now, it's not so much that the nation state is being threatened, but citizens within the global north or rich citizens in the global south are being threatened by their poor neighbors.
But hasn't there been, Akhil, for a long time, been the idea that, you know, poverty in the global south does pose a security problem for the West before 9/11?
Yes. So in the context of the Cold War, the idea was that poverty in the global south was a problem because poor people were attracted to communism, were more likely to be attracted to communism. And therefore, part of the imperative of foreign aid at the time of the Vietnam War and before, actually right after the start of the Cold War, up to the 1980s, was that we want to have strong efforts to end poverty in the third world, because if we don't do that, then people are likely to turn communist. And if they turn communist, then it'll basically shrink the geographical space and the political space for the West. This was very much the position taken by Robert McNamara, who was the Secretary of Defense during the Vietnam War. He stated this explicitly during the Vietnam War, and later on he became the President of the World Bank. And when he became President of the World Bank, he again restated this position. But it was by no means limited to McNamara. All the development intellectuals of that era had the same position.
So now we have these non-state actors, these, you know, they're called terrorists. And so then is the argument today that, well, poverty may not make people more likely to be communist, although that may still be a fear of policymaking elites in the West, but now that poverty in communities could lead people to take actions like those taken by the 9/11 actors?
Yes. So poverty now is seen as a threat for several reasons. One of them is that it can create frustration for people living in various parts of the world. Young people, mostly young men who cannot get jobs, they become political extremists because they are frustrated. They are unable to find employment. They are subjected, because of media, to extremist ideologies that circulate in the global public sphere. And for all those reasons, they are likely to turn to terrorism.
Akhil Gupta is professor of anthropology at UCLA, where he also directs that university's Center for India and South Asia. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Akhil Gupta about poverty, global poverty, human security, and what this focus on the security of elites in the global north means for the prospects for actually addressing and alleviating acute poverty around the world. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Akhil Gupta teaches anthropology at UCLA, and he is co-editor of The Anthropology of the State and of The State in India After Liberalization. We are talking about a very interesting essay he contributed to the volume Territories of Poverty. The volume is edited by Ananya Roy and Emma Shaw Crane. It's published by the University of Georgia Press. And in that volume, Akhil takes up a question which is really the title of his article. It's called, Is Poverty a Global Security Threat? So you were talking about how with this concern about the security now, not necessarily of poor people around the world, according to this discourse at least, but with the security of elites in the global north, in the rich Western countries, that poverty was seen as possibly, potentially, likely turning people who are poor into extremists of some kind, into people who might wreak some kind of havoc on the West. Are there other perceived threats from poverty that, you know, make people in this country, for example, fearful, wary, concerned about their own security?
Yes, actually, what changed was that with globalization came the realization that people were actually closely connected to each other, that there were links that tied people to each other because of interconnected markets and mobility and so forth. So the security discourse and the perception of threats actually increased when globalization was more fully formed, as it were. And there were a range of issues that were seen as threatening the security of elites in the global north. And what were these issues? Things like disease vectors. So the idea that whether it was bird flu or SARS or AIDS, HIV, etc., that they were poor people's diseases that originated in other parts of the world that spread very quickly. And now we are seeing that in the case of the Zika mosquito virus. So disease vectors, in fact, became a much higher concern than they had traditionally been after globalization. Similarly, the danger of biological weapons, bioterrorism, has risen in importance, and you can hear every day discussions about bioterrorism that in some way resemble the discussions that one often found earlier with nuclear terrorism. Then there are other realms such as environmental destruction. So the idea that environmental destruction, the destruction of rainforests in Brazil and Indonesia, were actually threatening the welfare of people in the global north, of elites in the global north, because they were changing not only the world's climate, but they were also changing, you know, available resources, etc. Similarly, there was the idea that dwindling biodiversity in the world might pose the threat because a lot of medicines, etc., were obtained from rainforests, from biodiverse species, etc. And dwindling biodiversity drastically reduced the chance of finding new solutions to various kinds of health risks. And then, of course, there's the ever important and never solved problem of unchecked migration and human trafficking, which has certainly become the hot button issues threatening the security of elites in the global north. In the last few months especially, you can see this with the refugee crisis in Europe and with the debate over immigration in the presidential campaign in the United States.
So if we return to your point about, you know, human security before 9/11 being really focused on the welfare, the lives and living conditions of acutely poor people around the world, and then that shifts after 9/11, so then human security becomes more focused on the security of elites in the global north, and they're worried about all these problems that you're talking about, disease vectors and terrorism and the like, much of which comes out of poverty or is perceived to come out of conditions of poverty. Well, then, could we say at least that a concern with the security of elites in the global north, that means, okay, well, then poverty needs to be addressed, right? Because if poverty breeds all these things that might harm us or hurt us, then we need to go out there and address poverty on some kind of grand scale, or at least more effectively than we do now. So although the appeal might be self-interested, right? The appeal might not be, hey, we need to help these people because they're suffering. And the appeal is now, we need to help these people because otherwise we're under threat. Because if we help them, we will be safer. So, you know, maybe the effect is the same. Or you tell me, maybe the effect is the same as far as still going out energetically and addressing acute poverty globally.
That's a very good question. And it is possible that one of the effects could be that we need to re-energize in the fight against global poverty. But I think, in fact, the trend has been in a different direction. And the different direction that it has taken is the following, that the idea has been, how do we make ourselves, that is, people in the global north, elites in the global north, more secure against the dangers that are posed by poverty in the global south and poverty at home, right? So, for example, if you were afraid about diseases that might be transmitted by contact, then one way to make yourself safer is to wall yourself in so that you're not in contact with poor people, either migrants or poor people who are part of your own country. Similarly, if the idea is that poverty is a threat because of migration, people, it forces people to migrate and therefore they are in your space, then the solution could be, let's build bigger walls, let's, you know, make sure people can't migrate, let's try to block them, etc. And so this is precisely why the refugee crisis in Europe at the present time is so interesting and so difficult, because it is accompanied by a call to make things harder for the migrants and to prevent them from coming. But it's basically, the idea is that, how can we secure ourselves against these people at the same time that there's a recognition that it is poverty, it is war that is forcing people to flee. And there is also a recognition that there is some responsibility. We have a responsibility towards that. And that if people were not poor or they were not insecure, they would not actually leave their homes and come to our space. So there's a paradox there. And that paradox, I would argue, is fundamentally driving what's happening with acute poverty today.
And is it fair to say then that the focus is less on the roots of poverty, the structural inequalities that go along with poverty, and more, as you say, toward how can we protect ourselves from migrants, from disease, etc.?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what has happened. And my argument is that once that shift occurs, then you no longer pay attention to the causes of poverty for the people who are poor. Poverty becomes a problem only because it's inconvenient or it threatens you, the person in the global north who's looking at poor people. And so it changes, it fundamentally changes the morality of the fight against poverty. Why are we interested in fighting poverty? Why are we interested in supporting the poor or helping the poor? Not because their lives are in danger, not because they're dying early, not because they're suffering, but we are doing this because, you know, it helps us feel more secure.
That's the voice of Akhil Gupta. He is professor of anthropology at UCLA And his books include Red Tape, Bureaucracy, Structural Violence, and Poverty in India. He published an essay in the volume Territories of Poverty, Rethinking North and South, about poverty and security and, to some degree, neoliberalism. That volume, Territories of Poverty, a link to that volume is on our website, againstthegrain.org, as is Akhil's faculty page at UCLA. And I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You, in this essay in Territories of Poverty, you indicate your agreement with what one of the editors of the volume, Ananya Roy, said, which is that poverty is being re-territorialized in the world today. What does that mean?
What that means is that once we start thinking about poverty outside the frame of the nation state, in other words, once we start thinking about something like global poverty, which is poverty that is inherently, we're thinking about something that's a larger space than the nation state, we're thinking about the globe as a whole, then we open up the question about what the relationship is between poverty, say, in the US and poverty in Africa or in India or in other parts of the world. And this is a relationship that has historically been missed in much of the scholarship on poverty. Because if you were a scholar like me who studied the Global South and studied poverty in a country like India, you didn't necessarily make a connection with poverty in the US. So the re-territorialization of poverty refers to two things. It refers, first of all, to the fact that we now have to think about poverty in the global north and poverty in the global south as being in the same frame. And secondly, we have to look at the global processes of inequality that are creating poverty both in the global north and in the global south at the same time. So it's not surprising that you have levels of inequality in the United States today that hark back to the 1920s. Not since the 1920s have we had the levels of inequality that we see in the United States today. And in a country like India, and even in a country like China, you're seeing rising levels of inequality. So in India, especially because we don't have a strongly communist or socialist state that is redistributing resources, you are seeing the rise of large numbers of billionaires. India has more new billionaires than any other country in the world. And at the same time, you see the persistence of acute poverty. And in fact, many people who are, if not absolutely poor, they're relatively poorer than they were before. So the question becomes, how do we think about these relationships? How do we think about the creation of poverty in different parts of the world as being part of the same global process that is also creating higher levels of inequality everywhere?
So would you say you disagree with the rather easy divide often made between global South and global North, right? There's these people in the global South, there's these people in the global North, and there's a kind of a clear line distinction between the two?
Yes. So part of my argument is that we really now need to rethink the categories of global North and global South. So first we started out with the West and the Third World, First World, Second World, Third World, then it was the West and the rest, and now it is global North and global South. But they all basically point to similar divisions, geographical divisions, between those nation states or places that were colonial powers and those that were colonized, and places, if they were not directly colonized, were under indirect rule of various kinds. That geography is no longer analytically very useful when it comes to thinking about poverty in the world today. And the reason is the following, that within the United States today, as I said, because of inequality, there are people who are extremely rich and there are people who are sliding down into poverty from being comfortably middle class. They are now tenuously middle class or they are now lower class. And their wages keep shrinking as a proportion of the total income. In India, similarly, you have growing inequalities and you have a class of people who are rich by global standards. So they're not part of the global south anymore in that sense because their incomes are as high or higher than most of the people in the global north. And in fact, they are on a par with the extreme, with the 1% in the global north, right? So those people in India who are in that position, those people cannot be conceptualized as somehow living in the global south. Why? Because they can insulate themselves from the living standards and the conditions of the rest of the population. So in South Africa, for example, you have people who live as if they were living in, you know, New York or San Francisco. Their living standards are the same. And then you have people who live in basically shacks made of metal and paper, etc., whose living standards are similar to people in India, right? So what you're seeing is the rise of a global elite in countries like Brazil, Mexico, India, Singapore, and places like that, who are just as rich and living lives that are very similar, that are more similar to the 1% in the global north than to their compatriots. And so what this calls for is a recognition that, in fact, the old geographical divisions between the West and the rest, between the global north and the global south, actually don't tell us what's happening in those places. That, in fact, we need maybe to rethink the way in which we've divided the world geographically. And we need new analytical categories that help us think about what's really going on in the world today.
You referred to rich people in, for example, India or South Africa, insulating themselves from their surroundings, from specifically from poor people. Can you tell us how that plays out in a nation you've been into and you've written a lot about, which is India?
I'll give you a small example. Today in India, you can be the child of a person who's comfortably middle class or upper middle class, and you can grow up in an environment in which you are stepping from an air-conditioned home into an air-conditioned school bus and going to an air-conditioned school and coming back to your house and living very, very comfortably, travel abroad in your summer vacation, eat at fancy restaurants that are opened by, you know, famous restaurateurs from around the world, etc. And you can lead that life completely cut off from 99% of the population in your own country. And if you go to a rural school, say even 50 miles away from where this person lives in a big metropolitan center, you can go even 50 miles away and find a child in a rural school who is sitting on the floor in the school, who has never even seen an air conditioner, let alone been in an air conditioned space, who doesn't maybe have electricity at home, who has certainly no running water, no sanitation, the teacher may be absent in school, and so forth. And that kind of division between the conditions under which one small segment of the population lives and the majority of the population in the country lives is something new. It's the result of processes of economic liberalization and neoliberalism. It didn't used to exist before. And so I think rightfully you could say that this child and these people who represent the 1% in India they don't really belong to the global South. They belong to a transnational North, in a way.
You know, what you're saying reminds me of what we were talking about earlier with this focus on human security, which after 9/11 changed to the focus on the security, or which meant the security of global northern elites, elites in the global North, and how one response to that security threat as they perceived it is to, as you were saying earlier about the people in India, these incredibly rich people in India, cutting themselves off from people, sequestering themselves, walling themselves off to the maximum extent possible from poor folks and the perceived threats that poor folks and poor communities present.
Yes. So that is a phenomenon that you find worldwide. It's not just in India. The growth of walled communities, for example, where infrastructure is independent of everybody else's infrastructure. So you have your own generators for electricity. You have your own water supplies. You have perhaps your own sewage treatment plants, etc. And of course, you have barriers to entry into these communities, security guards, heavily policed, militarized zones, enclaves, as it were. And these enclaves are now found all over the world. So whether you're talking about Rio or Sao Paulo, or you're talking about Mumbai or Delhi, you find very similar mechanisms that have come up in different parts of the world that insulate an elite from the rest of the population. And we see similar things happening in the United States as well. So what I'm suggesting is that these are global processes. These are not processes that are limited to one nation state. So if we see this as a global trend, and the kind of inequality against which the protests have arisen in the United States, we see that as part of a global trend, then we can see that what's happening, in fact, is a kind of separation between classes of people rather than between nation states from each other.
Akhil Gupta, professor of anthropology at UCLA. You may want to check out his book, Red Tape, Bureaucracy, Structural Violence, and Poverty in India, or his book, Postcolonial Developments, Agriculture and the Making of Modern India. Again, we've been talking about an essay he contributed to the new volume, Territories of Poverty, Rethinking North and South. Akhil, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.